Today's edition of Talk 10 Tuesday is sponsored by Ipsalooza, inviting you to register to win a free subscription to ICD-10 Monitor webcasts for 1 year. Enter to win before July 31st. Winner announced Tuesday, August 1st. We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for July 25th. Dr. James Kennedy is substituting today for Dr. Reamer as we welcome Dr. Jerry Petratos of Hitex, which is based in Epic's hometown, Madison, Wisconsin. Dr. Petratos will report on automated query solutions. We'll get the latest coding news from Lori Johnson. Tiffany Ferguson covers the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk. And Dr. Kennedy presents our talkback segment. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a man who still calls movie phone to hear showtimes, Chuck Buck.
I do indeed. Hello, everybody. Hey, thanks, Clark Anthony, and hello, everybody, and welcome to our 562nd live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, and good morning, Jim. And folks, Dr. Jim Kennedy has been substituting for Dr. Erica Reamer now for about five times on these Talk 10 Tuesday broadcasts. And Jim, I want to publicly thank you for all the great information that you've been passing on to our listeners.
Chuck, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be with the audience. Good morning, everybody.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks. And as you heard Clark Anthony announced, Dr. Jerry Petratos is going to be on our broadcast later this morning. And his solution appears to be amazing, that it helps to generate physician queries automatically.
Well, that's good. We need automation. I got things to do. I don't have the time to wait on a query, so let's get her done.
Let's get her done. So, Jim, what are you going to be saying today during your point of view, your POV?
I'm going to talk about a little bit about my conversation with the FBI.
Oh, good.
And we're going to talk about the ICD-10 guidelines.
Yep.
And the challenge with the index.
Well, very good. Excellent topics, Jim. All we'll look forward to hearing your point of view on those interesting topics, including the one about the FBI. We have much news to report, so we begin this morning with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Thanks, Chuck. And I recently became lucky enough to become a beta tester of Google's new AI-driven search tool. The advent of Google's AI-driven search tool, which can deliver customized health-related information to users, underscores a significant shift in the realm of medical advice. And while this technology promises enhanced accessibility to tailored health insights, it raises profound concerns about its potential impact on the traditionally sacrosanct doctor-patient relationship. Doctors and other healthcare professionals dedicate long years and rigorous training and education. Hospitals and Medicare share in this cost of providing this training. They blend their understanding of medical science with interpersonal skills, cultural competencies, and emotional intelligence, all of which form the foundation of effective medical practice. AI, however, intricate and powerful, lacks these essential human aspects. The key concern associated with AI-driven searches is the risk of misinformation. Even assuming Google's sophisticated algorithms work well, it remains impossible for patients to differentiate between evidence-based advice and speculative or false information. Misinterpretation of information by people, including those with political access to GRID, can lead to incorrect self-diagnosis, including undue panic, complacency, or even result in great harm or even death. It can strain the doctor-patient relationship, as physicians may need to spend additional time debunking myths and correcting misconceptions, distracting from time allocated to actual patient care. Furthermore, the personalized nature of AI-driven searches raises significant privacy concern. Although Google assures that user data is the mere fact that the user's health searches are algorithmically tracked and accessed could lead to feelings of surveillance and unease. This apprehension could discourage open communication between patients and doctors, thereby negatively impacting the therapeutic alliance. The rise of AI search tools also may contribute to a worrying trend called cyberchondria, the online counterpart to hyperchondria. Users might develop heightened health anxiety due to a misinterpretation or overemphasis of AI-generated results, leading to an increase in often necessary demand for medical consultations. This could exacerbate the already stretched healthcare resources and further complicate the doctor-patient dynamic. Finally, we must consider AI tools' potential impact on healthcare equity. As AI increasingly drives health-related decisions, there's a risk of a deepening digital divide. Those without access to the latest to technology or the digital literacy to use these tools effectively could find themselves at a disadvantage. This can exacerbate existing health inequalities, challenging physicians to bridge the digital chasm. However, it's critical to note that these concerns are not intended to undermine the potential benefits of AI in healthcare. From facilitating timely diagnosis to enabling personalized health monitoring, AI tools like Google have enormous potential to revolutionize the healthcare delivery system. They should be seen as a complement rather than a replacement for traditional medical consultation. To manage these challenges, it's necessary to incorporate stringent regulatory checks on the accuracy of the information generated by AI tools. Health literacy must be promoted so that people can interpret online health information accurately. And of course, robust measures must be required to safeguard privacy. And in conclusion, while Google's AI-driven search tool offers significant advantages in accessibility and convenience, it also raises critical concerns about the doctor-patient relationship, misinformation, privacy, and healthcare equity. To leverage this technology without compromising these aspects, a balanced, regulated, and inclusive approach is essential. Through open dialogue and careful strategy, the healthcare sector can harness the power of AI without overshadowing the irreplaceable role of our human doctors and caregivers. And back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's also the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. It's Tuesday, it's July the 25th, and you're listening to the 562nd live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday.
As a coding professional, it's crucial to have a clear understanding of AHRQ patient safety indicators. Their impact on the CMS Hospital-Acquired Conditions Program affecting 1% of a hospital's traditional Medicare revenue and ICD-10-CM present on admission status guidelines affected by these programs. This knowledge helps in accurate code assignment and avoids inaccurate reporting. During this webcast, you'll learn about AHRQ patient safety indicators with a focus on trouble spots, like foreign bodies left during surgery and postoperative respiratory failure. You will see key terms to watch for in medical record documentation to ensure proper coding and identify the need for documentation clarification. You will also learn to exclude clinically insignificant conditions that don't meet coding guidelines. Best of all, you'll learn how to identify documentation improvement opportunities and collaborate with clinical documentation integrity specialists and providers to enhance the quality of care. That webcast is now available on demand.
Now's the time for the Talk 10 Tuesday Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Dr. Kennedy. And hello to our listeners. Are all myocardial infarctions equal? Let's look at demand ischemia, non-ischemic myocardial injury, in type 2 myocardial infarction this morning. According to ACTIS, demand ischemia is a specific type of ischemia where oxygen requirements of the myocardium are not being met due to some increased need. The code for demand ischemia is I24.8. According to Coding Clinic, fourth quarter 2021, pages 14 to 15, non-ischemic myocardial injury is characterized by the rise and or fall of cardiac troponin levels with at least one value above the 99th percentile upper limit. The case presented is a patient who becomes increasingly somnolent. The diagnostic workup reveals elevated troponin level and intermittent atrial fibrillation. The patient did not have chest pain, did not have EKG changes, and the troponin levels stabilized. The provider documented non-ischemic myocardial injury, and the question associated with this case was, how do you code this diagnosis? And the response was I5A. Coding Clinic, fourth quarter 2017, pages 12 to 14, lists the type of myocardial infarctions. There are various types that range from type 1 to type 5. The type 2 myocardial infarction is a myocardial infarction secondary to ischemic imbalance, as in coronary vasospasm, anemia, or hypotension. there is a question in the issue, in this issue of Coding Clinic, regarding how to code a type 2 non-STEMI due to demand ischemia. The answer is I-21.A1, myocardial infarction type 2. Do not assign I-24.8. According to ICD-10-CM guidelines, codes I-21.01 to I-21.4 should only be assigned to type 1 acute myocardial infarctions. When I am auditing, I frequently see I-21.A1 assigned for demand ischemia only, but there is no documentation of the myocardial infarction. If the documentation is unclear, a query should be written to determine if the patient has a type 1 myocardial infarction, a type 2 myocardial infarction with demand ischemia, a non-ischemic myocardial injury, or just plain old demand ischemia. This query could avoid denials that occur after the payer processes the claim and reviews the medical records. While the query may slow down reimbursement, it will ensure that you are paid correctly for the patient's presentation. The takeaway is that demand ischemia does not equal I-21.A1. There has to be an MI with demand ischemia to assign this code. So that just happens to be a pet peeve of mine. So I wanted to pass that along. So also don't forget that the 28th of July is World Hepatitis Day. We talked about that last week. And with that, I will turn it back to Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you very much. This is Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant with Revenue Cycle Solutions.
Here now with the Talk 10 Tuesday report on the social determinants of health is Tiffany Ferguson. And good morning, Tiffany Ferguson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, everyone. So today I thought it would be helpful to discuss over the next couple of weeks, so today and next week, the calendar year 2024 Medicare physician fee schedule as it pertains to the advancement of health equity. I'm going to dive today specifically into the additional CPT codes and clarification on reimbursement for caregiver training and the addition of community health workers. So in calendar year 2022, CMS received recommendations for two codes, CPT code 96202, which is multiple family group behavior management modification training for individuals that care for patients with a mental or physical health diagnosis, administered by a physician or other qualified health professional without the patient present for 60 minutes. And CPT code 96203 is the code for the additional 15 minutes beyond 96202. In calendar year 2023, CMS added additional codes for therapy disciplines, PT, OT, and speech, to provide similar caregiver support. Although these codes existed in previous years, CMS had debated about the reimbursement because they did not involve the presence of the patient, thus creating some difficulty around the reasonable and necessary guidelines for reimbursement. However, in the proposed calendar year 2024, CMS has concluded that under certain circumstances, caregiver training can be medically necessary for the care of the patient, even if the patient is not present on the visit and appropriate for reimbursement. So guidelines for caregiver training are listed in the ruling on page 221. Now on to the major inclusion and advancements for community health workers. So CMS is proposing additional reimbursement for what is called Community Health Integration Services, CHI is what you'll see listed in there. These are the services that a physician or provider office coordinates and utilizes as extenders of social workers or other licensed professionals, which help in addressing unmet SDOH needs. The proposal is 2G codes that will be billed monthly under general supervision guidelines. The initiating G code is for the first 60 minutes of appropriate services, and then the follow-up is for those additional 30 minutes after that. And it's billed in monthly increments. Services of the CHI are expected to be conducted by community health workers. However, at this time, official certification for community health workers is not required for billing inclusion. So as this is being clarified by CMS, they're expecting comments to come through and recommending that. I would ensure that the healthcare systems and primary care clinics have a mechanism for describing the role and training of these these community health workers or other titles that match the expectations in the proposed ruling, even if they're not titled CHWs. I've seen many of these titles out there that do the exact same job as what they're describing in billing qualifications for this, such as community care technicians or community navigators. So with that, it'll likely meet the requirements. Just make sure you have everything spelled out clearly and it matches. Additionally, CHI services must tie back to SDOH factors that is present in the physician documentation. So these codes can serve as additional and separate reimbursement from the existing chronic care management services that clinics may be concurrently providing. Guidelines for CHI begin on page 236 of the proposed ruling. In my article out this week, I give an example of what that would look like. As far as how you would bill for those services. And then next week, I'm going to be covering SDOH assessments, reimbursement for that, and Z-code capture in the outpatient setting. Back to you, Dr. Kennedy.
Thanks, Tiffany. That was Tiffany Ferguson, the CEO of Phoenix Medical Management.
Attention coding professionals and all HIM professionals. There's an upcoming 3-day conference you'll need to attend to remain compliant with the 2024 Inpatient Prospective Payment System. It's the IPPS Coding Summit, produced by ICD-10 Monitor. During this exclusive 3-day summit, learn about important changes associated with the 2024 IPS, including new ICD-10 CM and PCS codes, plus insights, analysis, and answers to questions. Register now to attend this 3-day IP Summit. On day 1, learn changes to the ICD-10 CM codes. Day 2 is all about changes to PCS codes. And day 3 includes information about important changes to MSDRGs and the new technology add-on payment codes. The sessions begin August 15th and continue on August 16th and 17th. That's the annual IPS Coding Summit, produced by ICD-10 Monitor. Register now at the ICD-10 Monitor bookstore.
As you heard us announce at the top of the broadcast, providers and clinical documentation integrity specialists are using automated queries to capture acute and chronic diagnosis in the language and the manner required by ICD-10 conventions and guidelines. So with this rapidly developing technology, real-time documentation prompts and automated queries are assisting providers as they are writing their notes. Really interesting. So to learn more about this incredible solution, we've asked Dr. Jerry Petratis, may I call you Dr. P, to be our special guest this morning. Good morning, Dr. P.
Good morning, Chuck. Thanks for having me. Well, there's a few things I'd like to talk about with respect to the anatomy of automated solutions. First of all, the adoption of providers is important and very tricky to get right. We typically need an internal physician champion that can speak to the value of the solution and also help shape the logic. In addition to the CDI team, of course. And then we also need the support of the EHR vendor. In the case that we work with most closely, it's Epic. So we've learned that some providers don't want to do any revenue integrity or quality work while they're documenting their care. Others want to receive and respond to all of their revenue integrity and quality queries during care while the patient facts are top of mind. So We find that the system needs to be flexible enough to accommodate the documentation practices of individual providers, provider specialties, academic hospital systems versus community and for-profit systems. So that's what makes the implementation of these automated query solutions so complex. The other factor that we focus on is being able to track the behavior through dashboards, being able to look at the responses from groups of providers as well as individuals. We can learn a lot about their preferences and make changes to how and when they receive queries to make it a more usable system. And we also recommend baby stepping the amount of queries and providing enough training and education so the providers are aware of what they're seeing and the impact that it will have. So we often complement the implementation of an automated query solution with several reports that show what the impact is on a query by query basis. And that way we give confidence to the users that their responses will have a significant impact on the integrity of the documentation. Finally, there's the logic improvement, which we mostly focus with the CDI team on. And what we like to do is present a lot of data in a way that shows them how revenue integrity and quality are taking place at any given institution, at their institution, and how the mixture of both signs and symptoms and observational evidence plays a role in the validity of the query. You might have heard of something called clinical validation. So clinical validation is often needed because the provider will verify that a patient has the clinical signs and symptoms of a disease, but the data may not show that. The textbook ranges for observational data, and that includes laboratory test results, as well as vital signs and medications, are often measured in research settings and are not indicative of the real world, almost like a clinical trial. So what we need to do is we need to constantly ask providers why they've documented something if the corresponding data, observational data, differs from the textbook. And we've had a lot of success in being able to learn from the data so that when we're looking, for example, for a patient who may have sepsis or severe sepsis, we don't necessarily wait for all the threshold criteria to be reached. Rather, we look for what the signs and symptoms are telling us and how they're documented, and then try and match up to see if the observational data, for example, the SIRS criteria, or even various indicators of organ system malfunction are possibly present. So that's pretty much how we've been organizing, our automated solutions that we work with Epic on. And the next generation, which I think is really exciting, is generative AI. And I know Tim spoke about it briefly, but we are starting to integrate large language models into being able to help providers create the notes from the beginning using combination of different factors, including the past data of that particular patient, as well as the experience of the provider, and then the general medicine knowledge that is brought to the table to understand how to put all of the evidence that's present in the chart into context of a clinical note. I'm going to toss it over to Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Appreciate that. I know that a lot of folks are scared about AI. They're afraid it's going to take their livelihoods. But I tell you what, I'd much rather dig a hole with a shovel than with my hands. So tools are great. That was Jerry Petratis. Jerry is the CEO of Hitex, an Epic integrated solution based in Madison, Wisconsin.
As you know, when we have a guest on our program, a guest co-host, that is, as we do with Dr. Jim Kennedy, we ask them to share a point of view, a POV. Here now is my good friend, Dr. Jim Kennedy, with his POV. Jim?
Good morning, everybody. I had a scary phone call last week. That scary phone call came from none other than the FBI. After learning I'm not a target, thank God, the FBI was just trying to figure out how the coding system worked and why certain institutions tend to have higher case mix indices, higher CCs, MCCs than others. The thing that we went back to is we talked about the Kwashiorkor debacle, you know, which is about 10 years ago, of which Kwashiorkor was being reported. And the reason that Kwashiorkor was being reported was a fluke in the index. The index back in the day allowed for moderate malnutrition. Okay, the term was protein malnutrition. Just protein malnutrition in the record was indexed as Kwashiorkor. And that was what the system used in justifying the Kwashiorkor, which follows what the ICD-10 index says. If we look at the index under general coding guidelines, number one, locating a code in the ICD-10-CM to select a code in the classification that corresponds to a diagnosis or reason for the visit in the medical record, first locate the term in the index and then verify the code in the table. So this kind of hampers the coder, you might say, because the coder is obligated to go to the index first and then follow the directions in the table. On the other hand, what's made this a little bit tricky is that there's a lot of problems with the index and that the index will point to conditions that are not clinically reasonable. If I look at Coding Clinic, first quarter 2023, page 27, it says a basic rule of coding is that further research/review may be required if the code index does not identify the documented condition correctly. The trouble is how do you do this further research? How do you do this further review? The doctor documented one thing, the index goes to one thing or points to a term in the table, and is the coder allowed to use their own judgment, use their own whatever, when the index, the guidelines are explicit? That becomes a problem. So where this is really going to be a problem is that if you look in the new fiscal year 2024 index, look under the term cachexia, C-A-C-H-E-X-I-A. You'll find that cachexia that's not specified will go to E43, which is severe malnutrition. And this is going to be a recreation of the whole Kwashiorkor debacle, because now a coder is going to say, well, the index tells me to use E43 for cachexia, when we all know that cachexia and malnutrition are completely different. They have completely different pathophysiologies. They may look the same. They may even coexist with each other, but they're tremendously different. And now a coder is going to be forced to use an E43 code unless they go through this, quote, further research, end quote, or review that's required by the coding clinic. I've asked the CDC to change this, to amend this. They have not yet done it. It's only a change in the index. But nevertheless, this is the issue that we're dealing with today. One final thing, and I'm going to be very, very quick about this. Look in the new guidelines under the page 109 for what's the reporting of an additional diagnosis. They have slipped in the term clinically significant conditions that affect patient terms with requiring length of stay, clinical evaluation, so on and so forth. Why would the cooperating parties add the word clinically significant? What's the trip up there? What's wrong with what we had now? What do we need to do different with this language of clinically significant that's in the guidelines? This is something that we're all going to need to get our act together on. October the 1st is not that far away. And I would say that we need to have policies in place on how this works. Thank you for the privilege of speaking. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Jim, very much. That was an excellent topic for your point of view. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for our 567th live edition of Talk to Susan. I want to thank our panelists today, Tiffany Ferguson, Laurie Johnson, Tim Powell, Dr. Jerry Petratos, who reported our lead story, and a special thanks to my good friend, Dr. James Kennedy, for co-hosting today's Talk to Tuesday. And remember, folks, when you can't listen to us live, you can listen to all the Talk to Tuesday broadcasts on Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. And when you do, rate us. Give us a review. And one more thing before we go, never miss a Talk to Tuesday again. Simply visit ICD10monitor.com/podcast and join our community. Until we meet again next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD10 Monitor and Talk to Tuesday. Thank you again, everybody, and have a great week.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.